Hey, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm your co-host, Aaron Lammer, here with Max Zielinski of Longform and Evan Ratliff of The Atavist. It's a lovely morning in Brooklyn, balmy 51 degrees. How's it going, guys?
It's going great.
I'm in a good mood. I'm in a real good mood.
Max is in a good mood. I'm in a good mood. Evan is in the same mood. It's sweet out here.
It's a perfect day. Who'd you talk to, Aaron?
I talked to Sam Biddle, who is one of the two reporters at ValleyWag, which is one of the sites. It's a Gawker site that covers Silicon Valley, which seems to be a very hot topic right now in the media.
Silicon Valley?
I watched the Silicon Valley, the show. I watched the premiere of the show last night.
There's definitely going to be a pseudo Sam Biddle character on that show at some
point. I'm waiting for it. But Sam's a really interesting guy. He describes what he does as tabloid journalism, and I think he's the first person who's been on the show who would describe what they do that way, and I think that's an interesting topic, and he was very, very open in talking about it. So,
also, full disclosure, we met him at South by Southwest.
Yes.
We were there doing the podcast.
Bowling.
Went bowling. Bowled the game of my life.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you had what, two strikes?
Yeah.
What?
Two strikes, I think.
I think I had three strikes and a spare.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was two strikes.
That was
four frames.
That was also a weird drunken. You didn't get the full due for how good you were bowling because no one was paying attention.
That's why I'm going to keep bringing it up anytime I see any of those people.
Aaron, Evan's quite focused on not getting his due for that bowling performance, which was amazing. Two strikes is really good.
We should have a bowling sponsor this week. Do we have a sponsor this week?
Yeah. What's that terrible bowling place in Manhattan? The party bowl place.
Well, now they're. Who is our sponsor?
Our sponsor is Tiny Letter from the good people at MailChimp. It's a simple way to get an email newsletter going. Recommended by me.
Take it away, Aaron and Sam.
Hello. Welcome, Sam Biddle.
Thanks for having me.
Where are you coming from?
I'm coming from the very dimly lit Gawker offices in Soho, just right over the river.
Very nice, very nice. A lot of people who come on the show are long-form magazine journalists, and I think that job is kind of well-defined, but your job is less well-defined maybe to our readers. So you are now a reporter for ValleyWag,
right,
which is a Gawker subsite. What does ValleyWag do?
ValleyWag provides a counterbalance, countervailing force to sites like TechCrunch, and even mainstream newspaper tech coverage. It focuses on Silicon Valley, but also the New York tech scene. And it provides a critical, at times harsh and deliberately insulting view of that coddled world.
So for someone who, say, is not exposed to the complimentary tech coverage or the critical tech coverage, what is the conflict there? What is the sort of underlying basic tension between those two sort of rival journalistic camps?
So almost all coverage of tech, whether it's consumer tech or startups or just on the business side, is promotional. Companies, whether big and small, will send press releases or develop personal relationships with bloggers, reporters, editors. And then the publications in turn say, here's something that could be the next $5 billion idea. That's sort of the subtext. And so it's all at the very least neutral, usually erring on the side of utopian optimism that every idea has a chance. Every idea might change the world. We're dealing with geniuses across the board. And sometimes that's definitely the case. But most of the time, it's not, and so you don't get people who are willing to say, "I'm going to pass on this because it just doesn't make any sense." We don't need a fifth dry cleaning pickup service from your phone in San Francisco,
right?
I think sites like TechCrunch, which for people who don't read TechCrunch, is a pretty much by the numbers trade publication for Silicon Valley, and their philosophy has always been, we'll write almost anything about any company because they prize being first and having an exclusive on a company or a company announcement over everything else.
I mean, it's interesting to define what you do so much in opposition to something else. let's sort of like rewind before before the tech error. Is this an extension of how like business reporting has always gone down, or is there something unique about technology and the way it's covered that this has sort of emerged as an issue?
I think it probably flows right out of very old business reporting. I mean, the Wall Street Journal was always a pro-business paper,
right?
And still is. And then the contemporary offshoots, which cover maybe heavily startups, are the same. They exist not just to cover an industry, but to advance it. Because I guess existentially, if people stop coming up with new companies, they won't have anything to write about.
So what lights up your like storyboard in your mind? Like what's like what are the sort of like elements of something that you're like, yes, this is a Valley Wag story?
Oh man, I mean any kind of bad behavior, because I mean Valley Wag is, and just like Gawker.com, they are both tabloids.
Yeah,
I mean, and that's what it is. People often say, oh, yeah, right, you guys ready for a tabloid? I'm like, yeah, we'll be the first ones to admit it. The best story that I think we've covered so far, it'll be almost a year since Valley Wag has restarted last spring, was the Sean Parker wedding, the Facebook billionaire who had his nuptials in a redwood, an endangered redwood habitat. Whenever someone is completely removed from the standards of behavior that everyone else is held to, that's a great Valley Wag story. You're dealing with people who live in a fantasy world, both of in terms of what makes sense as a business and what is okay behavior for a human. I mean, you have people who will. There was one yesterday that will help people find get paired up with private jet pilots, and this is that this could be a viable business on its own is nutty. But then you have them applying the same sort of wacky senses of judgment to their private lives. So it usually goes both ways.
How much of that is, like, let's take that Sean Parker wedding story, which is a story that was reported widely, probably up to the New York Times,
right?
And your coverage of it was quite relentless and quite extensive. How much of that is original reporting versus sort of scouring the internet for other things and sort of compiling them into a stream of Sean Parker hate?
Right. I like to think it's both. And I think that something you can deliver that's original is being willing to say, this guy isn't just having an extravagant wedding. I mean, he's demonstrating sociopathic tendencies. I mean, there's really a personality issue, a character issue here. And that's something that the Times can't say and won't say. I mean, we're all looking at basically the same California state documents. They let out a report about the extent of the damage after the wedding. In that case, the state wouldn't talk to me. I don't think they would really talk to anyone. It is a lot of taking the same material, and it's a matter of what you do with it. Are you willing to say that this was not just a very fancy wedding, but that it was a reckless wedding, and that it was indicative of bad taste gone awry, and that Sean Parker is maybe a bad guy. It's that sort of willingness to take an original tone and to say what papers like the Times or the Post or the Journal won't, that I think set us apart. And it does come off as relentless. And I mean, I was.
Does that make the entire project something of an op-ed?
Yes, for now. I would like to see the site have more on the ground reporting. We're about to hire someone on the West Coast, which I think will make that a lot easier.
So the site is currently you and Natasha Tiku.
Yeah.
When you think of it as an op-ed in that way, whose opinion is Valley Wag?
The voice is one that says this industry does not deserve the universal praise that it receives. It doesn't deserve the pass it receives from people who should otherwise be criticizing it. And it's a lot of overgrown, entitled man children pulling price tags out of the ether and passing them around. I mean, it is considering Silicon Valley worthy of contempt is the sort of first premise that we work from. Not that it's all bad at all. I mean, I wrote for Gizmodo for 3 years. I really do love and am fascinated by technology. I'm not advocating some return to the Victorian era. It's just that it's arrived at a point where it is the new overclass. It is what Wall Street has been or was for so long, and will demonstrate the same excesses and the same poor behavior. So just, you cannot state that enough. That is the editorial.
I mean, that's
voice.
Certainly echoed. We had Kevin Roos on the show a few weeks ago,
right.
Who recently left New York, mm-hmm. and stopped covering Wall Street in favor of moving to California and covering California. And I read his book, and the most notable thing in his book is how boring the life of a junior analyst is,
right.
How incredibly sedate it is. There's a level to which the money is still there, but it's not the Michael Lewis Wall Street culture,
right.
of the 80s.
Yeah.
And some of that stuff has moved to Silicon Valley. Do you see that culture and the business as being inextricably intertwined?
I do. Yeah. It's because you don't move out there for the money, although the money is good, even if it's the hope of stock options or equity, which probably won't be an immediate payoff. You're going out there for the perception that what you're doing is cool. No one is under the impression that Wall Street is cool. People on Wall Street don't think they're doing anything cool. They're doing it for the money, and they're fine with that. And frankly, I'm fine with them being fine with that. They're at least open about it. You go to Silicon Valley because you think, I'm going to be part of something that's going to change history. That ends up maybe being an app that lets you hail a cab. The notion is that you're part of something world historical and really trendy and, you know, sort of sexy in how cutting edge it is and willing to experiment. So, you get to say, I'm part of this gold rush. It sounds cool, you know? I get the draw.
As part of a sort of a media counter narrative to that narrative, where does that original narrative trickle down from? I mean, how does it come? I mean, this was in Roos's book. How does it come that those same Princeton and Harvard graduates that were once aimed at banking are now moving to Palo Alto? What media sort of taught them that?
It was the same media that printed Google's "Don't be evil" motto over and over and over again without saying, "Well, does that?" First of all, does that even make sense as the motto of a company? And are they living up to it? That was propagated without any kind of skepticism that a company like Google was like, you know, Woodstock of big tech. Now I think it's clear to everyone that Google is, you know, is just another AT&T without scruples. And again, that's almost sort of fine if you're just willing to admit it, right? I mean, AT&T does not say that it's trying to change the world or that it's not trying to be evil. It's a big company with big plans. But, that myth that giant tech companies could both be giant and creative and noble, Apple also. I think Apple and Google are probably the two biggest. They're probably the originators of that myth. That someone like Steve Jobs was more Leonardo da Vinci than Andrew Carnegie or something. They were somehow given a pass. Their poor behavior, of which there was a lot in the case of a guy like Steve Jobs, was totally eclipsed by all the sexy, high budget TV ads, you know, for iPods,
yeah.
and stuff. I mean, and was not reconsidered until really his death. But by that point, you had a generation of kids who wanted to be the next Stephen Woz. That set in motion things that are still, I think, tugging on the minds of teens. You know, they still want that. That's still a very real myth to subscribe, to believe in.
So, you seem very confident in your view, that worldview. I'm wondering how you sort of came to that conclusion, like about your sort of your journey to become a dissident against
sure.
it. So
right.
You started at Gizmodo pretty much shortly after you were in
yeah.
out of college.
Yeah.
What did you want to do as a slightly younger man? You're still a young man.
Right. I always wanted to write for a living.
Yeah.
I was always, and still am, a pretty big tech geek. So that was just the subject matter I was interested in personally. And then I had a chance to write for a living about stuff that I was interested in. I mean, who would ever turn that down? And it was a great job. But towards the end, I started to get really frustrated. And it started to sort of make me feel dark. You start to see that really cool new phone, not just as a really cool new phone, but you're dealing with the PR people on the other side who are trying to manipulate you, manipulate a lot of people who are going to buy that new phone. You know, you read about, in the case of Apple, you read and research and write about all the, you know, labor abuses that take place behind the scenes. You read a biography of a guy like Steve Jobs and dig deep into his life. Just by being exposed to the industry for a long time, you have to either decide, I don't care that this is really just like any other part of the economy, and that it's mercenary, or you can say, this bothers me. You know, I mean, because tech is looked at unlike coal mining or unlike the car industry. When it's all the same ideas, right? You're building shit and selling it. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. But I think what's wrong is marketing tech as something noble and beautiful and somehow exempt from the same criticisms of the rest of capitalism, right? I mean, it's still just designing, building, marketing commodities. So, I mean, I think that I got sort of burned by buying into it and covering it for so long without, you know, being willing to admit that to myself. You know, I was just get frustrated.
I'm interested in the very first thing you said, because I always wanted to be a writer. I wanted to write professionally.
Yeah.
And that seems to be a fairly common thread among people
sure.
who become professional writers. But your job is pretty unique. I'm assuming that you weren't like, what I want to do is like start a tabloid where I like get into crazy fights with tech CEOs. So
yeah.
what...
That's for sure. Yeah.
What kind of writing interested you when you were younger?
God, any kind. I mean, there are some extremely embarrassing music reviews that I did in college that, thank God, are very hard to find on Google.
You got to watch out, because there's people who you have the right audience to track you down.
I can't even find them sometimes.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, that you know, there was a time when I thought, oh, you know, I'll write for Pitchfork, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think I would ever have been good enough to do that, but that was something that interested me, you know, sort of arts and culture stuff. You know, I think I just wound up there by accident, by a combination of being lucky and meeting some really amazing people who gave me a chance to cover tech. You know, if I had been recently out of college and someone said, hey, do you want to get paid to write music reviews? I would have said, great, that sounds fantastic. Maybe I'd be talking to you about something very different right now. But I mean, I did sort of wind up here without much of a plan. I was given a chance to write about things that I would have cared about even if I didn't have a job writing.
You've been in working at ValleyWag. You've gone after many, many CEOs of companies worth many, many millions and billions of dollars.
Right.
Fairly, like, personally, to the point where there are often stories about people's marital relationships,
yeah. Google,
their families.
Yeah.
This is not business reporting. This is personal reporting.
Right.
And I know that people have also, you know, that stuff does bounce back. The longest article I read in preparing for this show was not an article you wrote. It was a 4,000-word screed against you.
There have been a few of those,
That actually had some fairly, like, well-researched information about you that helped me prepare for this interview. But let's talk about that. There's a site called Pando Daily that is run out of Palo Alto. You became involved in a feud with them, and the article is a very, very pointed statement that you and Nick Denton, who runs Gawker, are hypocrites,
sure.
and here are the reasons why, and here is the reason why this whole sort of project is full of shit. And
right.
it includes information like who your dad is.
Right.
What is that like?
So that article came out while I was home for Christmas, and I think I read it the day after. I just thought, man, what a sad way to spend the holidays, like writing the Bible about me. If that's all people would like to spend their time and that's what they want to build their career around, you know, have fun. It didn't bother me. I thought it was, you know, my friends sent it around and we all sort of got a kick out of it. But, you know, I went back to work after that and everything was the same.
So what in your experiences has given you pause? I mean, have there been moments where you've thought, I've gone too far?
Oh,
Like, you tell me. Like,
sure. Well, you mentioned personal relationships. I mean, I outed the identity of Sergey Brin, the co-founder of Google. He was having an affair and I outed his girlfriend. And you know, Jesus, that's a fucking mess. He has two little kids. He has a wife. And so I remember going home, being back in my apartment, and a friend of mine who whose opinion I, you know, care a lot about, she was really upset by the fact that I'd done that. Yeah, it made me think, and I felt a little guilty, and I thought, should I have done this? I mean, I don't have time to really always think, was that a good idea? You have to sort of autopilot in the guilt area, and if it comes back, it comes back. I would do it again. That was what I concluded. I would do it again 100 times. But it was a moment where I stopped and really thought about how this was a person who was walking around somewhere in San Francisco right that moment and was probably having a very difficult day. On the other hand, it was someone who decided to have an affair with one of the most powerful men on the planet. I mean, Sergey Brin, as co-founder of Google, is certainly a public figure. He's one of the most public figures when it comes to tech. It's hard to respect the privacy of someone like that. I think even the notion of him having a private life after living off of monetizing hours is sort of silly. But again, that's my job, right? My job is to find and embarrass people in positions of power. And it was a hell of a story. And I'm, I would do it again tonight if I could.
So you said that you have to work on a certain autopilot. And I assume that part of that is related to the fact that these posts go up very quickly and that there is a time pressure with some of these issues, that there are, you do have competition that are trying to get this on the internet. But beyond the sort of linear autopilot, is it ethical autopilot? I mean,
that's what I meant.
So how do you draw that ethical universe?
So here's what I meant by autopilot. I'm a very big believer in sleeping on it, right? If you're worried about something, take a day, think about it. But if I took the time that I think most people would agree is sufficient to say, you know what, I am completely sure I'm doing the right thing here, I'd still be working on the Sean Parker story. You know, there'd be a backlog of a million posts. You have to use a bunch of intuition when it comes to, is this an ethically sound story? Is this worth hurting someone's feelings? I think that I've developed a pretty good instinct. There have been plenty of times when I have decided not to write about something. And I look back at those times and I'm very glad, because, you know, whether, you know, it's gratuitous or just hurtful for the sake of it. I don't want Value Act to ever just be mean for the sake of being mean. And I think sometimes it drifts into that territory, and I really try to stop that. But yeah, you know, I have to go with a sort of a gut game time call. When it comes to legal things, we are very lucky at Gawker to have a very robust and patient and very experienced legal team who is there to help with that sort of thing. Because yeah, I mean, it's my job to dig up dirt and spread it around, but not to break the law.
What are times that you've come sort of to the brink and pulled back rather than pushing post?
I have a folder of photos of a tech figure and executive in their underwear that I just cannot think of any justification for posting. Like, on paper, it's like, wow, yeah, tech CEO in underwear, great. But then I think, you know, what am I really accomplishing?
What is the sort of source for, like, particularly for the most contentious information that you've uncovered? Where is this stuff coming to you from, and what's your method for collecting stories?
You know, a lot of it comes completely anonymously. I don't know who sends it to me. My best sources are all people I'll never know.
I think a lot of people may not know what, like, an anonymous, like, source on the internet is.
Yeah.
What, like, this is like a weird email, like Hotmail address sends you, like, something?
There are plenty of services that let you send anonymous email from a disposable account. So, you know, I'll get an email that's like 60 characters of just gibberish, randomly generated letters and numbers at, you know, whatever.com, and it won't be signed. It'll just say, here's something I heard. That's it. And I can't reply because they won't read it. So it just sort of arrives there like a coin from the tooth fairy, and I can either do something with it or not. Sometimes it's not even enough to really act on, but that's how I get a lot of my good stuff.
I'm guessing, okay, so in the case of a photo, you can say whether it's a real or fake photo, but in the case of something that is not like doesn't have like a nice attachment like
right.
that proves it,
yeah.
You've got this anonymous email sitting in your box. How do you go about vetting something like that?
if I get an anonymous email that says I know that you know, Mark Zuckerberg is cheating on his wife, or I know that you know, Sean Parker is embezzling money, I'm not going to post that. I mean, God, I would love to get those emails. So if anyone knows that to be true, shoot me a message. If I get that message and it says I work at so and so, look up these names, and there's sort of the beginning of a trail, there's something to follow up. Also, if I start to hear the same rumor from what I can be sure are independent sources, it's not just the same person sending me the same message from different accounts, that's sort of a corroboration by consensus, right? It's sort of a smoke, ergo fire kind of thing. I'm also working, and again, I'll be the first to admit it, with a lower bar. It's a site that trades in gossip. So sometimes you present gossip as gossip. You're not saying it's true. You're saying this is what I've heard because you did hear it. You know, you have to sort of act like you're at a bar and you overheard a loud conversation.
Does that devalue when you do have something like great and it is not gossip? Does that devalue it that you do have a lower bar and that you've been publishing gossip?
It certainly makes it harder to persuade a skeptic or a critic of the site who says, well, you guys post things that you're not sure true. You know, and even if I say, even if I really do know something is true, but let's say it's coming from an anonymous source, I can't just say, come on, take my word for it. People who don't want to believe it aren't going to believe it. I think that's just sort of a hazard of the site. And if you read ValleyWag, you probably, you know what you're getting yourself into, which is that not everything is going to be verified or verifiable. If you trust me as a editor of the site, you'll be willing to take it on a little bit of faith, maybe.
I mean, what it sort of brought up in my mind when you said that was there's an interesting sort of doppelganger effect. You defined this site very much in relationship to sites like TechCrunch,
right,
that also rely heavily on gossip. In some ways, the tactics have sort of mapped each other. There's a eye for an eye element to it where you are both playing the same ball game, but for very, very different reasons.
Well, you know what's really funny? There is a cottage industry of Apple gadget rumors, of just, you know, minutia about, you know, how big the screen will be on the iPhone 6 or whatever. And those are all sourced anonymously. It'll be like, you know, we have a source in China who says X, Y, and Z about the next iPhone. And that will be spread around by publications you would expect that are not tabloids. People are willing to believe complete gossip, even from sources that don't have good track records, when it's something they think is exciting and they want it to be true. When it's something about them, there's a desire for that to be discredited. I think there are a lot of people in the industry who don't want ValleyWag to be believable because they might be the next one in it. Whereas, you know, everyone sort of is rooting for the Apple rumor sites because those are fun. Everyone can agree that, you know, everyone likes fantasizing about the next smartphone.
You know, Michael Lewis's book came out this week, and I wouldn't even really call Michael Lewis a critic of Wall Street, but Wall Street would call Michael Lewis a critic of Wall Street. And a lot of the response that I've seen from, I mean, this is a response by sort of crazy people, so take it with a grain of salt, but a lot of the response has said, like, well, this is a system. You would have to be a fool not to try to game the system. It's not capitalism if you don't use every tool you can to game the system. So what kind of like single-A baseball do you think we're playing that we would not try to manipulate the market with speed trading?
Right. That's why I love Wall Street, sort of, that they would just say that, right? No one would ever admit that in Silicon Valley.
Well, but they... The similarity is that there's a foundational myth. And there's become a foundational myth with regards to Wall Street that people who own publicly traded companies have a moral responsibility to do anything in their power to make money for it. And trickling down, people who run hedge funds have a moral responsibility. Everyone's got a moral responsibility to do. And there's an element to these tech companies that – it's not the same myth, but there's an underlying mythology that says we have a secret. There's a secret formula to doing the world better, and we've got that. Our system works. Your system does not work. it seems like it's easier to find out that someone is cheating on their wife than it is to find to sort of reveal the truly fraudulent parts of that mythology. What is the way that the sort of larger ideas get chipped away at?
It takes time, and I think it's a gradual process of debasing and, you know, just sort of fucking up the glamour, the infallible glamour of Silicon Valley and of tech as something that is uniformly positive. That is an inherent good. Technology is virtuous. If you show that that isn't true, little by little, I think that myth starts to fade. I mean, there's been no Watergate moment in tech, or maybe all the Snowden stuff will be looked back upon that way. But you start to chip away people's faith. And people start to feel, I would hope, a little disenchanted with the whole thing. If you can mount up even small examples of these people being full of shit, or these ideas not working, or people getting something they don't deserve, or whatever, I'm hoping that the aggregate is enough to spoil that myth a little bit. And when I say spoil, I mean, it's not like I just want to like fuck up someone's picnic. I mean, I think it's just bad for the economy, for the political economy, for so many smart people to be wasting their time with such trivial stuff. I think that it's great to encourage more people to study science and computer engineering and math. But to then take those people, gifted people, and have them work on like another way to send 10-second videos from phone to phone. I mean, you're squandering them. I would consider ValueWag a success if even a few people reconsidered taking that route with the gifts that they have.
The two biggest technology stories of the last year, as to my extremely limited memory, are Snowden is right. The biggest story, and the second biggest story is the failure of the healthcare.gov website. Right. I would say,
yeah,
and. What does it mean when people who are personally ridiculous have such a stranglehold on the talent that is necessary, that is truly necessary, because this technology is really necessary to effectively running the country.
Right.
We've proven that now.
Yeah.
I mean, are there elements of a necessary evil here? How do you view the parts that, you know, it's easy to like to throw away the like app that like tells you when someone you're in a room with went to the same high school as your girlfriend.
Right.
Okay, great. Throw it away.
Yeah.
How do we then regard the things that we can't throw away, like having a website for our national healthcare system?
Well, look, I think the really upsetting thing to me about the healthcare.gov fiasco is that it played right into the hands of Silicon Valley. They were able to say, we told you, you let the government run this and they're going to fuck it up. If you let the gang in Palo Alto do it, you could add 10 healthcare.govs. It played into every ego myth these people have about their own superiority, and you know that the government, you know, isn't helping anyone. I mean, there's a lot of very politically conservative elements in that the private sector will solve all. So I mean, I thought that was just such a shame, because yeah, we in the country we have now, we're going to need government websites that can handle huge numbers of people. I don't even see that as necessary evil. I mean, that's we need services that work that way. It'll help a lot of people, and I think, you know, now that it's working, it is helping a lot of people. That whole thing was the website was slandered. It was used as a propaganda device. Forget the Tea Party; that was as much of a win for the private sector of California as it was for the American political right.
Before you were at ValueWag, you did a story about sex cam studios.
Yes. Yeah.
I think people know what sex cam studios are, so I'm not going to try and describe
it. It's very easy to find out if you want to look it up.
It's on Google.
Right.
And it's a pretty deep piece. You really sort of dissect how the financial structures of the sex cam studios work, who are the kind of people who work in them and who are attracted to them, and you know the ways that they work in terms of money laundering. What that piece achieved for me was the piece isn't really a criticism of the sex cam industry, but it I was like, wow, the sex scam industry is really fucked up after
it is,
I read
it. Sure
it
sure is, yeah.
And what you've done since then, a lot of the pieces are more telling you that it's fucked. I mean, do you feel like you lose anything by being so clearly opinionated and presenting things more as opinion than sort of than research?
I miss writing that kind of story, yeah. Just personally. I think that when you're dealing with very obviously shady sex webcam websites, you aren't working against a prevailing culture that is pro sex cam website.
Yeah.
I mean, I could present it and people, if anything, were biased against international porn rings. If I'm talking about Facebook or if I'm talking about Yahoo or any number of any companies, tech companies, big or small, the bias is so heavily for these things as social and economic goods made by the best and the brightest that I do have to compensate, which means being, a demagogue sometimes. I have to say, look, this guy's an asshole. Because they've spent years hearing this guy's a genius, this guy's a gift, a king among men, So, I mean, I'm working with a pretty big handicap, I think, in terms of what every other depiction that people are used to. ValuWag is more of it can be a blunt instrument sometimes. Maybe it won't have to be. Maybe in the very near future, people will no longer be coming to the table with the expectation that tech equals good, that software equals good, that programmers are the best and the brightest. In that case, you could take a much subtler approach.
For argument's sake, let's say they're as bad or worse than you're portraying them to be.
Yeah.
But then you imagine you're not going to last long as an exec at one of these companies if you're like, hey, guys, I think actually we should start paying the city of San Francisco some taxes.
Right.
That's going to be like the first nail in your coffin. There are people who are dealing with these sort of heightened business structures that really are telling them make money at all costs.
Right.
Some of the rhetoric is bullshit, but when you take away the rhetoric, they are in a position where they are played in some ways into a corner.
In terms of what, being accountable to shareholders?
When you look at the sort of larger structural issues, not the like crazy parties, but the structural issues like not paying the city of San Francisco taxes.
Right.
Advocating for the shareholder, you would say, well, there's a way we can not pay taxes, let's not pay taxes.
Sure. Yeah. I mean that's the same sleight of hand that literally any publicly traded company would use, Exxon, whatever. I mean, any company that's doing something questionable but making a lot of money in the process will say, look, this is the way companies are. It's a truism if you believe them.
In a certain way, what you're arguing is that the people you cover aren't unique. They're actually more like oil executives.
Absolutely. They have the same basic mechanics and I think consciences as an oil company, but they're given this veneer. They get to have it both ways, which is be greedy, but be adored by the public.
Are you friendly or are in contact with other people who cover the technology industry from a more news perspective?
Absolutely.
Say like at the New York Times. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is it like when you sit down with a New York Times Bits blog reporter?
Sure.
And you're like, hey, we both did a piece on Facebook this week. Like what's the dialogue there like?
Those are some of my closest friends and biggest supporters of ValuWag. We have different jobs. The people at the Times are able to do stories that I could never do. I think it goes both ways. But I mean, it has meant the world to me that I've gotten such a supporting and appreciative reception from traditional journalists or bloggers or editors.
Do you have ambitions to jump those lines? Where do you go from here?
I don't know. I mean, I would like to do this until I don't want to do it anymore.
Until you've destroyed every last reputation.
Right, until we've moved back to a subsistence farming economy. No, I mean, my job is a lot of fun for certain reasons. Being an editor at the New York Times is a thrill of its own for a lot of reasons.
Right.
Those are just, I think they're very different. It's not that I don't think what they're doing is good or important. I just think you need both voices.
You burn some bridges doing what you do. Does it worry you, hey, in a few years when I'm sick of this, I will have burnt every bridge in, you know, in all these industries?
Right. I mean, that's possible, and it kept me up for a long time before I took this job. At this point, I am now confident I will not get a job at Facebook or Google or, you know, a venture capital firm. That's okay with me. Look, I look at the people who I've respected the most working along with them at Gawker, and people who've left, they go on to The New Yorker, to Salon, to Vanity Fair. I mean, look at Richard Lawson. He was the perfect torturer of a lot of very prominent people, and now he's a fantastic job at Vanity Fair, and he's still one of the best writers who's writing every day. I've burned bridges and closed avenues, and I would like to think mostly in jobs that I would have never gotten to begin with. And that's fine. It'll be worth it to me, I hope.
Do you see?
Ask me in a few years when
we're gonna have you back on the show.
When I'm sleeping under the
bridge,
exactly.
Ranting about Dave Morin.
Right.
But beyond actually the burnt bridges, the site's been hoaxed before, right? I mean, things that were later proven not to be true have been sort of supplied to the site and then had to be pulled back.
In my time there, there's been one instance that I can think of, and it was that Google bus protest.
Google bus, that's what I was thinking about.
I can't think of any other times when we've posted something that's been just entirely false or fabricated.
That hoax got 78,000 blogs, right? I mean, tell people what this hoax was.
So there was a video released during one of the protests against Google's private bus system. And there was a video that was uploaded purporting to be a Google employee who got off of the bus and had a confrontation with one of the protesters and said a lot of almost comically horrible things like, well, if you can't afford to live here, just get out. You know, the city isn't for you. A lot of things to that effect.
In retrospect, it's kind of like someone acting in an improv show.
Right. It was as if you had said, be as terrible as possible.
It's not just badly written. It's written in a way that someone would have kind of come up with 30 seconds before
right.
they said it.
That was a case of me wanting something to be true.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't want to scapegoat. I mean, it was uploaded by someone who was a reporter in San Francisco and said that it was a Google employee who they saw got off the bus. But I take full responsibility. I should have been more skeptical. I should have waited for someone to corroborate that, maybe.
The part that I find interesting about it isn't that you and all these other people got hoaxed and people are getting hoaxed all over the fucking internet,
sure.
All day, yeah. every day. It's that in some ways there's a sort of outrage economy mm-hmm. on the web.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that outrage economy goes both directions. There's a lot of people who want to be outraged about tech companies. There's also a lot of people who want to be outraged at people who are outraged at billionaires. You know,
right.
There's just a nice, healthy, fat turkey of outrage wherever you look for it. And part of what outrage does is it creates fuel for itself.
Yeah.
So it creates the kind of stories that corroborate the worldview of
right.
the people, and that's getting more sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
I remember in when I was working summers when I was in college, and you'd go and look at stuff on Snopes and find out it was fake, and it was that shit was pretty amateur.
Right.
Fake stuff on the internet
right.
was more pranking your friends, fake stuff that then would spread around the world, but was very easy to sort of locate.
Well, think how quaint it was. You could even catalog it on one website.
Right, right? Exactly. There was a database of all of the hoaxes
right.
at that point. And now that outrage machine, it has a demand.
Look, if I post a story and I know that it's going to make a lot of people pissed off, that's not going to be a strike against it. I mean, sometimes the outrage economy functions because people are rightfully outraged.
Do you have secrets yourself? I mean, does working in an atmosphere where you're at times doing things like outing people,
right.
how does it affect your own personal life?
I mean, you have to think every day, what would happen if what I'm doing right now appeared on the front page of Gawker? I mean, there's an old adage, just, you know, you never send an email you don't want to see, you know, online.
Every time someone says it, I'm like, fuck, they didn't tell me that until like 10 right. years into email.
I only heard that about a year ago. Yeah, I right. So, I mean, and I especially trying to keep that in mind. I had a really, maybe not formative, but a very, very heavily influencing talk with John Cook when I first started doing, when I first restarted ValleyWag. And, you know, he made it clear, you know, you're going to be under more scrutiny than ever before. You know, this is a guy who's had, you know, Fox News come after him, and he knows what it's like to have the counteroffensive. And, you know, he said, you know, the best defense is just sort of living clean, you know. and I mean, I of course I have secrets. And of course I'm not a completely open book, because I'm a human being. But I do think and second guess a lot of my life now, because I think, well, you know, what would happen if that got out by someone like me.
I mean, have you had something like that? Like, has it actually, like, have you made a decision in your life differently because
yes.
of that?
I've made choices in my personal life. There have been relationships that I have not pursued or whatever, because it would not look good.
Because they're people who operate within the realm of the world you operate in, or
sure, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of like one particular case, yeah, which is a shame, in a way, because I mean, I you know, you are very directly sacrificing a personal decision, something that would be a good thing otherwise for your job, but I mean, that's just, the alternative is much, much more grim, and that's meant. Forgoing things that probably would have made me happy.
What is your relationship like with John Cook? Or Cook is gone now.
Yeah, Max
outgoing
Reed
is Max Reed, and yeah. and Nick Denton is the godfather of the operation.
Yeah,
and I would really like to get him on the show. If you're listening, Nick Denton, please come on the show.
I'll pass that on.
I've sent him Nick. I've sent you an email. why you not write me back? No, but I'm interested in, like, when someone who's been doing this for longer than you is sort of jumping you into the gang.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what kind of advice does someone like that give?
You have to be willing to have people say really horrible things about you all the time. You have to get some pretty thick calluses. I mean, I cannot imagine a form of invective that has not been used against Nick Denton.
What is the worst thing that you remember someone saying about you?
I think it might have been worse when I was at Gizmodo, because people really fucking care about their phones.
Yeah, it's like funny. It's funny. You like reveal someone's affair. It's not nearly as strong as like an Android opinion.
Oh yeah. I mean, I would get people would say the most vile things about me when I wrote a bad review of a Samsung phone, and now it's more focused. You know, right. But I don't get the same like fucking kill yourself faggot. Like I would get emails like that about a phone.
Yeah.
I got used to it early is what I'm saying.
So, I mean, there's a sort of a flip side to working in an atmosphere like this that I think is interesting for writers and people who listen to the show, which is Gawker is very open with metrics. I think you can just go online and look at all of the sites and all of the individual writers,
mm-hmm.
which is always fascinating to me.
If you go to quantcast.com / whatever Gawker site you want to look up, there's full traffic information about them all.
In a way, it's sort of like putting writing on the sort of quantified self movement early by doing that. And you've now been, you know, you've been now getting weighed in every day for what, 3 or 4 years?
Yeah.
How does being able to see stuff like traffic and see like how people react to your writing and the comments and stuff, how has that affected what you write? I mean, has it been a way that you've tried to improve your writing?
Well, it's tough because I don't know any other way. My first job was writing for Gawker. And so I don't know what it's like to not be able to see how every single thing you write does. I'm with scare quotes. I mean, of course there are going to be art stories that don't get a lot of hits, but I know are important. And conversely, there are going to be posts that are monster traffic, nuclear bombs, but are about trivial shit. That's just, you know, the mystery hand of the internet at work. I know that if there's a story that I'm proud of, that other people are really into and appreciate, and it's good work, and it doesn't perform well, I'm able to divorce myself from that. But I don't think that it really affects what I do. I mean, I think that there's a perception of Gawker where, like, we're getting constant, like, printouts of what's working, and it's like, you know, more stories about, you know, people with brown hair, you know, yeah. Like, we're getting these very finely tuned you know, carrot and stick kind of thing. It informs what I write for sure, but it does not determine it. People talk about writing things with the hope that people will read them as if that's a bad thing, as if not every fucking writer since the history of the written or spoken word has wanted an audience. Otherwise, I'd be at home.
That's why I bring it up. It's interesting because a lot of people who've been on the show who mm-hmm. write for print magazines and then who then sort of trickle the stories onto the web have almost no insight into the success or failures of stories they've done from a traffic perspective, or just really like how what they're doing plays into the larger company that they're a part of.
Well, right. As far as their own, you know, fortune and future at the company, I don't know. But, you know, with Twitter now, everyone can get
right.
immediate feedback. You know, if you write for a magazine that has no internet presence, I mean, I'm not even sure what that would be. But if you're not getting traffic feedback for your job, you can sure as hell get Twitter feedback. You can, you know, you're either starting a conversation or you're not.
Is it difficult to operate in that kind of an environment without like an editor, like a sort of a strong editorial voice, above you saying like, we want you to do this? Do you see yourself as your own editor?
Yeah. I mean, I think people don't get how much autonomy there is at Gawker, which is almost complete autonomy. Very few of the stories you see on Gawker are there because someone said, write this.
When you say, I want to write this, and you're out there and you know you've got a great story and mm-hmm. it's something you like really believe in, and you're like, fuck, I don't know how I can make this better. How do you, I mean, how, where do you go?
Who are always there to work on a story with you.
So they don't assign it, but if you bring a story
yes.
in, it does get
that's absolutely
line
right.
level edited.
Yes.
Transitioning from doing like a Samsung review to doing like a feature story
yeah.
about like Cam Studios.
Right.
Like, what is that like from a prose level?
It is one of the most rewarding things I've ever gone through. I mean, people complain so much about getting rewritten. I love it when something doesn't look like it did when I turned it in, because I know it's better. It goes without saying that I feel better about those things that were edited and that I put, you know, my heart into versus a phone review.
I think that's as good a place to end as any. showing some heart and passion.
Sure.
Thank you very much for coming in.
My
Sam
pleasure.
Biddle.
Thanks for having me.
We'll see you again in a few years.
I'll be shaking a styrofoam cup full of change outside your office.
Hey, you wouldn't be alone. And that was the Long Form Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer. My guest was Sam Biddle. My co-hosts are Evan Ratliff and Max Linsky. Our editor is Jenna Weiss-Berman. Our intern is Sarah Button. Our intrepid sponsor is Tiny Letter. We'll be back here next week.